You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Defense Secretary Leon Panetta said that the new debt ceiling legislation, which cuts Pentagon spending by $350 billion over the next decade, is just part of what his department is going to have to live with. But he argued the potential second round of across-the-board spending cuts later this year would be completely unacceptable. On the other hand, Stephen Glane, who has been a reporter at the Wall Street Journal for 20 years, argues in his new book, which is called State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire, that defense spending should be cut even more aggressively. It's published by Crown. I'm very pleased that it brings Stephen Glane back to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Before it was the Department of Defense, it was called the Department of War. How significant is the name change?
Well, name change took place, I believe, in 1947. With the National Security Act, and this was the act that gave us the CIA, the World Bank, et cetera, all the institutions that we know today. And the name was changed, and it's an interesting euphemism in a way. It implies a defensive posture as opposed to an offensive one.
And it suggests that the United States would never go to war on its own,
right,
even though we have a few times.
Yes, we have.
And during that time also, George Kennan came up with his containment doctrine.
That's right.
You say that's been corrupted. Can you remind us a bit about what the doctrine stated and why you feel it's been corrupted?
George Kennan, of course, was the famous diplomat and statesman. And he produced this, what was known as the Long Telegram, which later would become distilled into the policy of containment, which was the bedrock of the Truman Doctrine, which was to meet the Soviet threat wherever it may emerge, largely because of the fears of Soviet hegemony, which was actually resided in, largely in the minds of prominent American militarists like James Forrestal. That policy was essentially militarized to the point where it ultimately scandalized even Kennan himself.
But there was a Soviet threat.
And
Stalin did believe in expansion.
Well, if you look at a map of where the Soviets were compared to where the Americans were, certainly, and I make this point in the book, there was the Eastern European bloc of Soviet proxy states. That was very much their strategic depth, and they had bitter memories of being invaded by the Germans or the Poles going back many centuries. And drawing the line as far west as they could was considered a strategic imperative. But elsewhere, in the Middle East, in Asia, they did not have the preponderant forward deployments that we had. And I would like to alert your listeners to a document that was commissioned by the Pentagon in the 1990s and which was declassified just last year, called Soviet Intentions. And to the Pentagon's lasting credit, in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, it sent its researchers to interview the leading lights of the Soviet military establishment, and it makes fascinating reading, and it makes conclusively clear that the Soviets' ambitions in terms of global hegemony simply did not match the Americans, largely because they did not have the resources.
Although they did invade Afghanistan.
Well, it's very interesting. If you look at the motivation or the intentions, that was, there have been other additional archives that have been declassified where you can actually get into the Politburo meeting where Yuri Andropov, the then head of the KGB, was telling Brezhnev, the chairman of the party, that intervention was necessary to save a Soviet proxy from a Muslim and an Islamic insurgency. It had nothing to do with Persian Gulf oil or the Soviet desire for a warm water port.
Are we still applying the Kennan containment doctrine today?
Yes.
Because there's no Soviet threat.
Yes, we are. In fact,
who are we containing?
Well, you could argue that we look the Soviets, as the narrative goes. We seem to be gradually losing our interest in the so-called war on terror, and now we're looking east towards China. And if you just
look, China is considered a serious military threat.
Well, the Pentagon is sizing it up to be one, and I'm concerned that we're not having the kind of national dialogue to discuss such a prospect. without and as a result, the Pentagon is continuing to deploy and to prepare without any checks or balances.
Harry Truman made a decision that had a lasting impact on the world when he ignored Secretary of War Henry Stimson's warning mm-hmm. that not internationalizing the atomic bomb would lead to a desperate arms race.
Yes.
Why did Truman decide that it shouldn't be internationalized?
Because it was politically expedient to do.
He was under attack. It was the Alger Hiss situation and so many others.
Yeah.
McCarthy was up there saying that there were so many communists in the State Department.
Yes, the second Red Scare was well underway. And I would point out a leitmotif of the book, State versus Defense, is how presidents would be pressured to go to war largely against their better instincts because of political imperative.
But the Soviet Union then exploded an atomic bomb. At
mm-hmm.
that point,
yes.
there was no reason not to internationalize it.
Right. As James Forrestal said, he said the bomb is an entitlement to the American people, and we should not give it up. The U.S., again, unlike the Soviets, and this is based on declassified information, almost had a religious embrace of the bomb. And at the same time, its doctrine was quite cavalier. One of the things that shocked Eisenhower was just how decentralized launching authority had become, so that a four-star general who has to attend a conference or some kind of meeting would delegate the authority to a one-star who would delegate it to a colonel.
And then there were think tank people like Herman Kahn
yes.
who were writing papers as to what would happen if we hadn't if we dropped a bomb on the Soviet Union.
Yes.
How much of a price would we pay?
What was unthinkable for the Soviets, and they unofficially had a no first use policy, and it became official in the 1980s. We wargamed for a first use. We contingency planned for first use, not officially, but it's certainly there.
Now, was the decision to isolate China under Mao Zedong also an extension of George Kennan's containment doctrine?
It was, and it was contrary to the endorsements or the recommendations of the policymaking establishment, beginning with Kennan. The sinologists in the State Department, the so-called China hands, all believed that sooner or later we're going to have to deal with the Chinese, and they were the first ones to say that whatever relationship China might have with Moscow would be tactical in nature and unsustainable.
But then they were all accused of being a little too friendly to communists.
They were destroyed politically.
Do you argue that the expansion of the wars in Korea and Vietnam resulted from an unwillingness to pursue diplomacy with China?
I think the record is quite clear. Zhou Enlai, Mao's number two, told George Marshall in 1944 that he wanted to go to Washington and meet with Roosevelt. So as early as 1944, they were talking about siding with the Americans. Because keep in mind, the Chinese and the Russians had been strategic rivals for many centuries. And at the end of the war, everyone knew that it was the United States that would survive unharmed, whereas Russia was turned a rebel. So it made sense for the Chinese to side with the Americans.
Ho Chi Minh also tried to open up talks with the United States. We rejected him as well.
That's correct.
Was it because we just didn't trust him? We really had no sense of what Mao's real designs were. And then mm-hmm. later, he was willing to bring China to the brink of destruction out of ideology mm-hmm. during the Cultural Revolution. So was he anyone that we could really negotiate with?
I think that the specter of Munich cast a pall on the whole foreign policy process. You had at every – one thing I found out researching the book was at every inflection point where a president had to decide how he was going to define U.S. relations with non-allies or even neutral countries, he had to deal with charges of appeasement, of capitulation, and that greatly informed his decision. And I argue in the book that had the U.S. reciprocated the Chinese outreach, there would not have been a Korean War.
Well, you spent time in Hong Kong before Hong Kong became part of China, writing for mm-hmm. the South China Morning Post. Did you get a very different sense of China than people in this country might have?
China was a very different place than it is now. It's changed remarkably. I think for good reason, the Hong Kong Chinese have a very conflicted view of China. But I would argue when I went on to Korea after China, then there were other feelings, and obviously they remember the Korean War differently. But I think that the record shows that that the United States missed a supreme opportunity in the 1945-1950 time period.
My guest is Stephen Glain, G-L-A-I-N. His book, State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire. It's published by Crown. During the Eisenhower years, there was also a series of CIA-engineered coups,
yes,
and attempted coups. Can you talk about those and why Eisenhower opted for secret operations instead of diplomacy? And also, were the CIA's actions a reflection of the Pentagon strategies, or were they reflecting what the State Department wanted?
Well, that's a good question. The Eisenhower administration was almost bipolar in its approach to superpower relations. It, on the one hand, it was very concerned about runaway budgets. And, of course, we all remember Eisenhower's farewell address about the military-industrial complex, which really resonates today as we speak. So he wanted to keep the military, the Pentagon budget, under control. He did this. He offset the spending on conventional weaponry by ramping up the nuclear strategic arsenal, the so-called New Look. But he also...
Was that John Foster Dulles's strategy?
This was Eisenhower's doing, and it was one of the few... he had a very interesting relationship with Dulles. He would go along with him. Sometimes he would break publicly with him. So that was his way of giving a sop to the hardliners, while at the same time keeping the budget under control. On the other hand, he was very aggressive and took a lead role in prosecuting his Secretary of State's plots to overthrow some of these leaders, these leaders that were identified as communist proxies or Soviet proxies, but in fact were simply nationalists.
Mossadegh, Lumumba.
The perfect examples. And of course, that the aftermath of the consequences of the overthrow of Mossadegh, for example, would redound to our disfavor.
More recently, Americans have blamed, or many Americans have blamed, the Bush administration and its war on terror for the trillions of dollars that have been spent by the Pentagon. But you argue that this has been a longstanding policy pursued by every president since Eisenhower, since Truman?
Well, when was the last time the Pentagon budget actually declined? I mean, I think Nixon may have checked it briefly, and of course, after the Cold War, there was a brief dip in spending. But by the time Clinton stepped down, those funding levels were back up to where they were in the Cold War.
Was Nixon more open to relying on state? After all, he went to China with the help of Henry Kissinger.
Mm-hmm. Well, he certainly embraced one of the greatest, and he's responsible for one of the greatest diplomatic initiatives of the Cold War, which was the outreach to China, and then the signing of treaties with the Soviets, the so-called triangulation. But he did everything. He concentrated everything in the White House, and he and Kissinger were basically running the show at the expense of the State Department, which often had no idea what was going on.
Yeah, I spoke to Henry Kissinger recently about going to China, and he said they went because of the skirmishes between the Soviet Union and China. And I asked, well, what would have been so terrible if war had broken out between the two? And he said, well, the Soviet Union would have won. I still am not sure why that would have been bad for the United States.
Well, they certainly did almost go to war, and the Soviets were actually considering use of nuclear weapons, which would have been catastrophic.
Had it gotten so bad between the two countries?
Well, it was largely the product of an ideological struggle. The Soviets were trying to keep a check on its proxies from provoking the United States, whereas the Chinese were more ideologically pure. But it's also because the two sides have been at each other's throats for many centuries, especially when it came to Manchuria. The Russians were always trying to bite off a little bit of that, and the Chinese didn't like that.
And also, Mao was more sympathetic to Stalin than he was to his successors.
That's correct. And because Khrushchev was a softliner compared to Stalin.
Stephen Glain's book is State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire. It's published by Crown. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Stephen Glenn, who's been a journalist for 20 years. He spent 4 years in Hong Kong writing for the South China Morning Post before he joined the Wall Street Journal in 1991, and then had stints in Tokyo, Seoul, Tel Aviv, and Amman. And he's written about U.S. foreign policy for pretty much every major publication. His latest book is State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire, published by Crown. Can you talk about the charges from the political right in 1965 that the Democrats were appeasing the Sino-Soviet bloc?
This is
at a time when there was a lot of tension between the two countries.
Between China and
the Soviet Union.
That's correct. The State Department made it very clear that the so-called Sino-Soviet bloc was breaking apart as early as the late 50s. But this just did not register either on the Pentagon's radar and certainly not on conservatives in Congress. They refused to believe it.
And LBJ couldn't make the argument? He couldn't just... I mean, he was great at convincing people, wasn't he?
Well, but he had to establish his credibility as tough on the Soviets in exchange for support for his Great Society programs, and he didn't want to lose that.
So instead he militarized our role in Vietnam.
In 1965, that's correct. He sent the Marines to Da Nang, and that was the first major deployment. That effectively militarized the war.
What was the State Department's position on the decision to pursue a military policy in Vietnam?
The State Department then had no position because it was then at the time run by a very weak secretary, Dean Rusk. His position was that there should be no daylight between him and the Secretary of Defense, who was the very hawkish McNamara. Mm-hmm. And so it was a period of dormancy.
Now, McNamara has expressed regret.
Yes.
Did LBJ ever express regret?
Well, he certainly expressed torment. I think that he was haunted and tormented by his actions because in the end, of course, he could not turn the war around.
And he couldn't run for office again.
No.
Jimmy Carter, you're right, played a role in expanding the Pentagon when he unveiled the Carter Doctrine in retaliation for the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. He's often characterized as not tough enough militarily. It's one of the reasons he lost to Ronald Reagan.
That's correct. And it's largely because the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which I argue in the book, based on this fascinating archive that is now available online, he misinterpreted the intentions of the Soviets. This was just the kind of regional power, superpower, helping out a proxy state that the United States has done on many different levels, especially in the context of radical Islam. But it was embraced by conservatives in Congress as a proof positive of the Soviet thirst for Persian Gulf oil and Middle East hegemony, which was wrong.
So we sent a lot of arms to the Mujahideen.
Yes.
And they wound up using those arms against us. And
right.
We actually played a major role in creating Osama bin Laden as a powerful figure.
That's correct. I don't think there was a direct relationship between the CIA and bin Laden, but certainly they helped to empower his cause.
So what was the Carter Doctrine?
It was that any attack on the Persian Gulf will be perceived as an attack on a vital U.S. interest, and the U.S. will respond accordingly.
And how, in the light of that, did he come to be depicted as weak on the military?
The fact that he did not anticipate the Soviet invasion, and he did not create... It was argued that the withdrawal from Vietnam created a culture of appeasement that the Soviets took advantage of, but also there was the failed attempt to rescue the hostages in Tehran, and that was such a blunder that it effectively destroyed his candidacy.
Well, was that his strategy, or was that the military's mess up?
It was a perfect example of how inter-service rivalries can sabotage a mission. And there are many examples of that.
Well, we've seen other missions not succeed.
Right.
In fact, the attempt to capture Osama bin Laden was a real mess up until finally he was found. How many years later?
Well, it was 10 years. Mm-hmm.
Did the military buildup during Ronald Reagan's administration play a role in the fall of the Soviet Union, as his admirers claim? Mm-hmm.
We'll get back to George Kennan. In 1925, he wrote a memo or a cable that accurately predicted the fall of the Soviet Union based on its own internal contradictions rather than an external threat. By the time that Reagan assumed office, the Soviet economy was so sclerotic, and its own military-industrial complex was so pervasive, so omniscient, that it was bleeding the economy dry.
I had friends who were visiting the Soviet Union at the time, coming back and saying, that country is a total mess. It's a third-world country, yeah, except for its military.
Yeah.
And, well, I'm sure people from the U.S. government must have seen the same thing.
Well, again, there's this undercurrent or subtext of the book is that presidents routinely ignore the advice they get from their people on the ground, whether they're diplomats or military attachés or spies.
So what was the Reagan arms buildup really? Was it mostly conventional weapons, unconventional weapons? Much of the talk was about the so-called missile defense, Star Wars.
Yeah, it was across the board. It was strategic as well as conventional, as well as tactical. To be fair, they certainly made it a lot easier to serve. They improved pay and benefits, and as a result, the all-volunteer force was really established.
My guest is Stephen Glenn, whose book, State Versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire, is published by Crown. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. It wasn't until the Bush administration's militarized response to 9/11 terrorist attacks that the Pentagon was empowered to directly allocate funds among foreign governments to modernize not only their militaries, but other security forces.
Mm, that's correct.
Who oversees that?
Well, that's a good question. Under the act signed by Senator Kennedy, which essentially spelled out who has authority over aid, all aid programs has to go through the State Department, even military cooperation and arms deals. In 2005, then Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld insisted on having his own spending authority so that special operations or irregular units can work with tribal leaders and give them schools and give them waterworks and also means of developing intelligence and surveillance. This has grown from being just a few hundred million dollars to, I think, $1 trillion funding authority, and the oversight is dodgy.
Well, what are some examples of the security forces that we might be funding?
Well, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee several years ago commissioned a study to delve into that very question, and a lot of it is helping allies with civil society things, but it's also working with some governments to enhance their internal security. These are governments which have a very bad human rights record, so it's across the gamut.
And it's led to all sorts of concerns about what we're doing with Pakistan, for example.
Yeah, correct. That's a perfect example. And Pakistan is I think it's the largest recipient of USAID today.
One of our listeners, Patrick from the Bronx, left this question on our show page. There was a famous showdown between Donald Rumsfeld and Colin Powell, mm-hmm, during the Bush presidency. Is there any sign that the relationship between Leon Panetta and Hillary Clinton will compare to those fireworks?
It will be hard to match the Rumsfeld-Powell duel in terms of animosity.
And Powell lost.
And Powell lost. He was effectively turfed out.
What about Condoleezza Rice? Did she have, she seemed to be more to have, mm-hmm, the president's ear, yeah, but did she really have much more of an impact ultimately?
To me, she was the Dean Rusk of the Reagan administration. She did not assert herself in a role that requires assertion and requires the dispensing of tough advice as to who to talk to. I mean, the National Security Advisor is very much like a traffic cop. And she very much failed in that responsibility. Now, getting back to Clinton Panetta, I think they'll have a very good relationship because they have worked together in the past. But also, Secretary Clinton is something of a hawk. She's endorsed the use of force in Libya, for example. Her mantra, the slogan that she uses in order to define her approach, is defense, diplomacy, development. Defense first.
Mm-hmm. Well, she was a supporter of the invasion of Iraq,
mm-hmm,
which
that's
the
right
president opposed.
Yes, that's correct.
And yet they seem to be in agreement on almost everything. Mm-hmm. Has the battle between state and defense played out in any way in our current policies in Afghanistan and Iraq?
Well, I think what we have now is a State Department which is very much of the liberal interventionist school. So the sake of intervening militarily in places for the sake of the general welfare, I personally think that's a paradox. And we have a Pentagon that is now assuming more and more civilian authority. So the two sides are kind of morphing together in what is essentially an assertive military-led foreign policy agenda.
Defense Secretary Panetta has argued that we cannot defend the country with more serious cuts to mm-hmm. Pentagon spending, but you're arguing that that isn't the case. Can mm-hmm. you walk through your arguments?
Yes. There's been a lot of talk now about the need for the Pentagon to reform itself, and there is a lot of room for that, especially when it comes to its medical insurance and pension system, which suffers from the same problems that the civilian realm's entitlement programs are suffering. Too many people taking out, too few people putting in. This Pentagon also has an appallingly bad accounting system, which routinely loses money every year in the trillions of dollars. That's with a T.
Because they never had to worry about keeping the books well?
Well, they've been obliged to since 1991, but every year...
Those famous toilet seats.
Yes, exactly. But every year, the Pentagon's own Inspector General issues a report saying we cannot account for $1.1 trillion or $2.7 trillion worth of assets or liabilities, or they refuse to make a comment altogether. But no one is talking about the major cost center, and that's the cost of maintaining hundreds of thousands of troops overseas in what effectively are Cold War legacy deployments.
You mean in Korea and Germany and places
Japan,
like
Japan, NATO. We have an enormous presence now in the Persian Gulf.
So would those cuts be enough to make a serious dent in the deficit? For example, this morning, Steve Inskeep said that entitlement programs were made up the largest part of the federal budget. And Bonnie Franks said, mm-hmm. no, that's not true. In fact, the Defense Department has a lot bigger budget than Medicare, for example.
Well, through my calculations, entitlements altogether account for about two-thirds of the budget. Whereas national security spending, meaning the Pentagon's budget, as well as security-related spending that are not on the Defense Department's books, is equal to about $1 trillion. That's 20% of the budget. So I would disagree with Senator Frank, Congressman uh-huh. Frank, but it still means we're spending $1 out of every $5 on defense.
And how much could we afford to cut and still maintain our security?
Well, we need to have a discussion about where our interests lie. I mean, you started the discussion by saying accurately, what do we need all this firepower for if there doesn't seem to be an existential threat on the horizon? And, of course, it seems like China is shaping up to be that threat. There are a lot of people who disagree.
Well, I guess the argument there is right now China is not threatening us. They're mm-hmm. too tied to us economically.
Right.
But if we appear to be really weak, they might change their approach?
Well, there's nothing in 3,000 years of Chinese history that suggests they aspire to be a global superpower. On the other hand, it has always been a regional power. During those 3,000 years, Asia has been a Sino-centric bloc. And this is something that American security planners haven't really had to deal with, at least not since the Cold War. So we have to figure, to what extent are we prepared to contest China's destiny, or how it sees its destiny as the fulcrum of Asia, and concede some authority on its coastline, for example, or at least to negotiate to find a peaceful solution to the various claims, counterclaims of certain sea lanes, or are we prepared to go to war with China?
Well, how much of that involves China's concerns over Taiwan and the United States' continued support of Taiwan?
It's a big part of it, but it's ironically relations between China and Taiwan are as close as they've been in a very long time, and yet the Americans insist on selling Taiwan weapons, even though Taiwan is indefensible.
Stephen Glane's latest book, State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire, is published by Crown. thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Leonard. It's great to be back.